The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop, looking out over London.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight, with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Oh, well, welcome to a Wednesday. I am Nicole Sandler. You found us, the Nicole Sandler Show, live at 3 p.m. Eastern at NicoleSandler.com and the YouTube channel. And, of course, we are heard on the Progressive Voices Network these days at 5 Eastern, 2 Pacific, and, of course, on the podcast anytime you want. It's downloadable from, you know, iTunes and Apple Podcasts and all those regular podcast places, and from NicoleSandler.com. Always free, though we operate the way National Public Radio does. We are fully listener-supported, and we depend on your contributions to survive, but it's voluntary. So for the people who, you know, just can't afford it, I understand. But if you can, you know, maybe you'll chip in. Anyway, here we are. It's a Wednesday. Donald Trump is already left Dayton. I guess he's now on his way to El Paso. Why? I don't know. It's an ego thing with him. As you know. All right. We like to start the show, for those of you who are new, we like to start the show with something humorous, because generally throughout the course of the hour, things get kind of stressful and you know, we could use a lift. We could use a laugh. We all need those diversions, especially in the time of Trump, things to take our mind off of the seriousness and the total fuck-upedness. Yeah, it's the word I made up, of the situation we find ourselves in. So we need diversions. We need laughter. We need music. We need fun. We need stuff that's not politics, right? So I'm not the biggest Barbra Streisand fan. I appreciate her talent, but I'm not, you know, was never a big fan. My husband, David, is. I was kind of shocked a little bit that he had tons of Barbra Streisand CDs and everything when we moved in together. I like some of those early Barbra Streisand movies, you know, Funny Girl and The Way We Were and On a Clear Day, you know, right? But I wouldn't put on a Barbra Streisand CD or anything. But that might change. That might change, because Barbra Streisand is now on tour. She just played Los Angeles for the first time in at least a decade. And she brought out a new take on an old favorite. You know, Send in the Clowns? I think it's Send in the Clowns. I think that's the song. She debuted new lyrics, too. So, with no further ado, and this is going to get me a copyright violation, but that's okay. YouTube, have at it, whatever. It's not like I get that much revenue from YouTube anyway, just in case you're wondering. Anyway, let's. With no further ado, you're going to have to listen, because obviously somebody in the audience just recorded this on their phone camera, but it's really worth listening carefully to get it all. All right, and we've got video. So take it away, Babs. Here we go on the Nicole Sandler Show.
I need to contain myself. So like yesterday's story where a Trump-appointed judge is blocking New York State from releasing his tax returns, you know? Jerry, you know what I'm talking about. So this kind of goes like this. He says he's rich. Maybe he's poor. Till he reveals his returns, who can be sure? Who is this clown? something's amiss. I don't approve. Now that he's running the free world, where can we move? Name me a town. Just who is this clown? No, we don't have a bridge, but I have another verse. Want to hear it?
Yeah.
This is no farce. It's not just smoke. Is this his art of the deal or some awful joke? You've got to admit this fraudulent twit is so full of.
There you go.
I can't say.
Yeah, Barbara Streisand almost cursing there, but the audience did it for her. I believe that was at Madison Square Garden just last week. That fraudulent twit, something something piece of shit, which works for me. Babs sounding pretty good there, and good on her. I'm glad she did that. All right. Good. She'd want to sing the word shit, but the crowd did. You can always count on New Yorkers for that. All right. Before we get to the news, I want to tell you what the latest fake controversy is. What's got the right wingers all up in arms? They're just apoplectic over this. So let me give you the background. Joe Scarborough, of whom I am not a fan. In fact, you know, he's the guy from Morning Jerk on MSNBC. He blocked me on Twitter years ago, so I can never see what he tweets. But apparently, yesterday, Joe Scarborough tweeted something that reads this. He wrote, any business that donates to Trump is complicit and endorses the white supremacy he espoused in Charlottesville with his center back chants and by laughing at shouts that Hispanic immigrants should be shot. Donors' names are on FEC reports. They are newsworthy. And then he continued, corporations are prohibited by law from contributing direct. Oh, this wasn't him. This is just a fact. Okay. So Joe Scarborough tweeted that. And here's a fact that follows that up. Corporations are prohibited by law from contributing directly to any political campaign, obviously, including Trump's reelection campaign. But there is a loophole that allows corporate donations to a group called Trump Victory. It's a joint fundraising committee between Trump's campaign and the Republican National Committee. So Joe Scarborough made this statement, got a little bit of pushback and criticism because, you know, that's what the Trump people do. And then Congressman Joaquin Castro of Texas, he represents the San Antonio area. Now, this is not Julian Castro, former mayor of San Antonio and former, I believe he was HUD secretary under Obama. Joaquin Castro, who is Julian Castro's identical twin brother, he took Joe Scarborough's tweet a step further, and he identified all of the individuals in San Antonio who gave the maximum donation to Trump. In fact, let me put this graphic up on YouTube so you can see it. If you're watching on YouTube, he tweeted this out, or he put it on Instagram or whatever he used. And he said, sad to see so many San Antonians as 2019 maximum donors to Donald Trump. The owner of Bill Miller Barbecue, owner of the Historical Pearl, realtor Phyllis Browning, etc. Their contributions are fueling a campaign of hate that labels Hispanic immigrants as invaders. I say, it's brilliant. After all, as Joe Scarborough pointed out in that tweet that I couldn't read on Twitter because he blocked me, this is all in the public record. In fact, if you look on this graphic, again, that I have up on the YouTube screen, at the very bottom it says, source, Federal Election Commission. And he's got this list of the people who have maxed out in their donations to Trump. There are 44 of them from San Antonio. And he listed them. Retired Mary Barrett, August H. Beck III, A.H. Beck Foundation Company, Malian Bowman, self-employed, Phyllis Browning of the Phyllis Browning Company. It goes on like that. Honestly, going through the names, and there are 44 of them, I don't recognize any of them. But people from San Antonio know who these people are. So I think it's brilliant. But I got to tell you, Joaquin Castro is now being criticized by a wide swath of people, including the New York Times and Maggie Haberman. In fact, this is where I first saw that Joaquin did this. Because Mary, Maggie Haberman was in sort of a Twitter fight with him, saying, "I will not put all those names in my Twitter feed," alleging you're taking the right wing party line, as it were, that these people are being doxxed by Joaquin Castro. That couldn't be any further from the truth. Doxing somebody is giving out their personal information online. If their phone numbers and home addresses were listed in this, yeah, that would be doxing them. That would be wrong. But all Joaquin Castro did is name the names of the 44 San Antonio donors who have maxed out on their contributions. They've given the maximum amount allowable by federal law to the Donald Trump campaign. It is a matter of public record. People can look it up. All Joaquin Castro did was make it easier for us to figure out. Well, some people are very, very, very upset. Let me see if I can find, okay, it's not in that article. It must be in this NBC News article. So the right, the Trump people, and the Neanderthals, the maggots on the right, have been criticizing Joaquin Castro. How dare he list these names of people who've contributed the maximum amount to Donald Trump? They said, okay, reading from NBCNews.com, the tweet prompted criticism from the Trump campaign and prominent conservatives. Trump campaign spokesman Tim Murtaugh accused Castro of publishing a, quote, target list in a statement that called the naming of private citizens and their employers both, quote, reckless and irresponsible. He is endangering the safety of people, constituents he is supposed to be representing. No one should be targeted for exercising their First Amendment rights or for their political beliefs. The congressman defended himself last night in a tweet responding to criticism from House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. What Kevin McCarthy wrote, listen to this hyperbole. Kevin McCarthy tweeted, targeting and harassing Americans because of their political beliefs is shameful and dangerous. What happened to when they go low, we go high? Or does that no longer matter when your brother is polling at 1%? Americans deserve better. Wow. These people, they are the champions of projection. Talk about low blows. First of all, you Republicans want to call out Democrats for harassing and targeting Americans because of their political beliefs? So Joaquin Castro responded also on Twitter, no one was targeted or harassed in my post. You know that. All that info is routinely published. You're trying to distract from the racism that has overtaken the GOP and the fact that President Trump spends donor money on thousands of ads about Hispanics invading America. And it went on from there. I was going to open the phones and say, did Joaquin Castro do anything wrong? But that's kind of a bullshit topic. He did nothing wrong. This is insane. But again, Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, let me see if I can't find, I'm not going to be able to find it now because I didn't flag it. And let's see, Maggie Haberman, NYT, is that it? Oh, I must have spelled it wrong. Anyway, she, you know, was saying, I wouldn't retweet that because here's her Twitter feed. Let me see. And there's probably, you know, so many more tweets since that came through. I just thought, again, it is so, what's the word I'm looking for? Not condescending, but hypocritical. I mean, this is the stuff they do on a daily basis that they're criticizing. Here, okay. So Rick Wilson wrote, and he is a right wing, he's a Republican strategist or something. He wrote, "The reaction to the Castro tweets identifying Trump donors is interesting to me. When I came out against Trump, his political allies and his pet media organs went after me, my family, and my company and clients. We've lived with 3 years of death threats and harassment. Do I wish that on people? No, it's awful." And then he said, "I have no truck for Castro." I don't know what that means. "But what he did is no longer unprecedented. I promise you not a single Republican who opposed Trump doesn't have a story about harassment, abuse, intimidation, and threats and all that." So anyway, Rick Wilson is saying what he did was not so wrong. And then Maggie Haberman retweeted that as a way, I guess, to defend her her opinion on this, which was that Joaquin Castro did something wrong by tweeting out this list of people in his district who have maxed out in their contributions to Trump. I don't see why that's a problem. But the New York Times has another problem today. And this is, they came up with a headline after Donald Trump's speech. Was it yesterday or the day before? Whenever he commented on the shootings, I think it was yesterday, actually. And you know, when he gave lip service to, you know, he actually said the words white supremacy and racism. You know, he didn't take credit for his own feelings about those things. But anyway, so the New York Times last night was preparing today's newspaper. I'm going to read to you from the Columbia Journalism Review because they say it better than I could paraphrase it. At 9:13 p.m., Nate Silver, editor-in-chief of 538, the statistical news site once published by the Times, sparked a social media furor with a tweet of today's front page, what was to be today's front page. A banner headline appeared over a pair of stories on Trump's White House speech addressing the weekend's two mass shootings. Silver commented, quote, "Not sure the headline that read, 'Trump urges unity versus racism,' is how I would have framed the story." Right? That's the headline they were going to run with? Trump urges unity versus racism? I don't know what speech they listened to, but it certainly wasn't what I heard. Then Columbia Journalism Review continues and says, "Not long after, Joan Walsh of The Nation and CNN tweeted that she had canceled her New York Times subscription and urged others to do the same. Quote, 'I know a lot of folks will tell me I'm wrong, I'll miss it, but I can't keep rewarding such awful news judgment.'" And she continued, "Trump urges unity against racism is almost as bad as their full-page Comey letter coverage just before the 2016 election. Nobody learns." So that happened. Within an hour, Tom Jolly, the New York Times print editor, tweeted an image of a new edition. They changed the headline. They succumbed to the public's outrage and disgust. And so the second edition of today's paper had a different headline. The headline reads, "Assailing Hate, But Not Guns." He's not assailing hate. He read the fucking words. That's not assailing anything. He said what he said, and you know, and he read some words off of a teleprompter in front of him that he had no connection with at all. And again, the new headline is equally horrible. So if you're seeing anything on social media today excoriating the New York Times, this is the reason. Now there's like a campaign to get people to stop subscribing to the New York Times. Here's why I think that's wrong. Because we need the New York Times and we need the Washington Post and we need newspapers who actually spend money on investigative journalists. And yes, there are sites like The Intercept and like a few others who the American Prospect, who actually employ journalists and want to do, you know, the work of the Fourth Estate. And when they do something stupid like this, we need to call them out. But you don't need to pull your support. We're seeing newspapers go under in city after city and town after town all across this country. Newspapers are disappearing, and they are an important resource. Maybe that's something we'll speak with Harvey J.K. about today. He wrote the book on Thomas Paine, in addition to others. And so maybe we'll explain to him. BuzzFeed News, absolutely, Randy Watson in the YouTube chat room. But print newspapers, and especially those with the legacy and history of the New York Times and the Washington Post, it's important that they continue, but it's important that they continue to do what they used to do, which is objective journalism. That's the tentative part there. Anyway, so that's going on. All right. I mentioned our guest today will be Harvey J.K. You know him. Harvey used to be a regular guest on the show. He was on every other Thursday in the old days, the before cancer days, BC. We talk about politics. Harvey J.K. he's got the best job title of anybody I know. He is the professor of democracy and justice studies. How cool is that? Teaching young people about democracy and justice, what this country is supposed to be based on. I don't know how he navigates the shit show we're living in today, but he does. Harvey's been working on a new book. It'll be released right around my birthday, the end of October, beginning of November, I believe. And I'm sure he'll come back on before then. But so Harvey J.K. will be along in a little bit. Before we get there, we may as well jump into what's news. And you know what? We'll do the recorded version today because we can. And not that much has changed since then, other than Trump already did Dayton and he's on his way to El Paso. Other than that, here's today's news.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Although there was no official invitation extended, the White House resident will visit El Paso, Texas and Dayton, Ohio on Wednesday. Trump's public schedule doesn't give any details about what he'll do there, but he tweeted that he'll meet with first responders, law enforcement and victims. Despite the scripted words he read in his televised address on Monday, in which he called for unity, Trump's hatred and calls for division are on display in his Twitter feed. Just before midnight Tuesday night, he tweeted at presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke, quote, Beto, phony name to indicate Hispanic heritage, O'Rourke, who is embarrassed by my last visit to the great state of Texas, where I trounced him, and is now even more embarrassed by polling at 1% in the Democrat primary, should respect the victims in law enforcement and be quiet. El Paso's mayor, Dee Margo, explained the realities around Trump's visit.
President Trump called me yesterday. He was very gracious in the call. You all know of my history with the president as I've defended El Paso. He's coming out here on Wednesday. And I want to clarify for the political spin that this is the office of the mayor of El Paso in an official capacity welcoming the office of the President of the United States, which I consider is my formal duty. I will ask President Trump to support our efforts with any and all resources that are available. Our recovery is no small task. Together we will rise out of this tragedy, and I'm here to ensure that we receive every state and federal resource that is available to us that we need.
Other elected officials in El Paso aren't quite as tolerant of the president's rhetoric. Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, along with the Border Network for Human Rights and Women's March El Paso, plan a gathering at 12:30, just down the street from the University Medical Center, where Trump is expected to meet with survivors of the shooting. Organizers say the event is meant to honor those killed, call for gun control, and confront white supremacy. Meanwhile, area medical workers began a petition asking University Medical Center, the hospital treating several of the wounded victims, not to host Trump. By the way, Donald Trump still owes the city of El Paso about $500,000. According to invoice documents obtained by CNN, the city of El Paso initially billed the Trump campaign $470,417.05 in reimbursement for costs for his rally. But in a letter dated March 27th, 2019, the Office of the Comptroller of the City of El Paso wrote to the campaign that if it did not pay its debt within 30 days, a one-time 21% collection fee, nearly $100,000, would be added. They didn't pay. The total invoice with the late fees now stands at $569,204.63. Trump will also travel to Dayton, Ohio, skipping Toledo this time around, I guess, where Republican Governor Mike DeWine said he thinks such a visit is appropriate. The mayor of Dayton, however, Nan Whaley, doesn't agree, saying she'll greet the president, but adding,
"He's made this bet and he's got to lie in it. His rhetoric has been painful for many in our community. And I think that people should stand up and say they're not happy if they're not happy that he's coming."
Democrats in Congress have called on both Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell to call their chambers back for a special session on gun violence. A group of Democrats led by Representatives Tom Malinowski of New Jersey and Veronica Escobar of Texas urged Congress to work on legislation to combat domestic terrorism and suggested in a letter that Nancy Pelosi also cut recess short for House members. In another letter, likely to be delivered on Wednesday, Democrats are calling on Mitch McConnell to bring up two House-passed measures that would strengthen federal background checks for gun purchases. The two bills passed the House in February, but McConnell has refused to hold a Senate vote on the legislation.
Democrats want Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to bring back lawmakers from their five-week summer recess for a vote on stalled gun legislation.
Mitch McConnell needs to get off his ass and do something.
That sentiment heard outside McConnell's Kentucky home where protesters gathered Monday night. Despite the inaction, a source close to McConnell says he's serious about considering gun legislation.
We're being told by sources right now that Republican leadership is not considering ending their recess and coming back to Capitol Hill because Mitch McConnell still feels that that universal background checks bill that Democrats have been calling for still does not have the support of the president or most Republicans in the Senate. Instead, they say they want to stay in touch with the White House about potential legislation they could get passed when they do return in the fall. And our sources here at the White House are telling us the president has expressed some openness to expanding those background checks in the last few days. But right now, the question is whether or not that's something he does still support in the coming days or if it's going to be something that he'll back off of in the end.
And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, which is now heard Tuesday through Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 Pacific on the Progressive Voices Network and always available via podcast from NicoleSandler.com. I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate. All right. So, sorry about that. There was a little bit of the news of the day. I just want to play one more clip for you from Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley because she's the real deal. She had a press conference today of some sort with Senator Sherrod Brown. And here's a little bit more of what she had to say.
This for us in Dayton, we hope so. I'm not holding my breath. Too often we just see complete inaction because they're waiting just for time for people to forget that 9 people died in Dayton because of a gun that was shouldn't be legal, frankly. I pointed out to the president that governor, former Senator Mike DeWine, voted for the assault weapons ban. There was a time when this was bipartisan. And so we're looking for those people in Congress to come together because the majority of Americans agree. So this should be an action. Do I think that we're going to see another mass shooting tomorrow or Friday? Probably, because Washington will not move.
So there you go, Nan Whaley. Again, Trump has already departed Dayton on his way to El Paso. We probably won't deal with it anymore today. If anything newsworthy happens, I'll tell you all about it tomorrow. Because we got Harvey J.K. coming up. But before I get Harvey on the line, just quick breaking news just popped up on my screen. Two bodies found in Canada are believed to be those two teens sought in the killings of a tourist couple and a university professor. So, yeah, that manhunt in Canada, I guess, turned up the dead teenagers. Good riddance. All right. Where's Harvey?
Well, where is he?
Where is who?
Where is Harvey?
Oh, you mean Harvey J.K.
Yeah, Harvey.
Well, he's coming up right now on the Nicole Sandler Show.
He is. In fact, I'm calling him right now. I think he's there. Harvey, you there?
I am here, yes.
Yay. So for those who missed my little intro earlier, Harvey J.K. has the coolest job title in the world. He's the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. So people come to your class thinking, okay, well, we're going to learn about democracy and justice. What a great topic. Do you have the leeway to teach whatever you want in those parameters?
I do indeed. And so this fall, for example, I am team teaching with other members of our program a course called Introduction to Democracy and Justice Studies. And my best buddy and I, a young guy named John Shelton, who's a labor historian and works lately on teacher strikes, he and I are handling the first month. And we're going to talk about, we're going to have the students explore the democratic and social democratic tradition in the United States. And it should be good. They're going to work all the way from Thomas Paine to Franklin Roosevelt and A. Philip Randolph and folks like that. And I'm sure along the way, we'll also end up talking about Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and people like that.
Right.
And then at the upper level, which is, I was hired to do this. I'm giving my age away here, but everyone knows I'm up there. Mm-hmm. I teach a course called Historical Perspectives on American Democracy. And in this instance, we really do go the full range of American democratic, small d, democratic politics from the American Revolution all the way through to the contemporary age. And we split the week. On Mondays, we do sort of the week's news. And on Wednesday, we go back in time to talk historically, from Thomas Paine to Martin Luther King, you might say. And in that class, it's usually about 25, and they're upper level students. That course is my reason for being, you might say.
And how are the kids? I mean, you're in Wisconsin, which is, well, it's typically a pretty blue state, but you're in Green Bay, which is not Madison. What is your classroom made up of?
Well, I think because of the title Democracy and Justice Studies.
Uh-huh.
The students who opt into the program have at least some interest, if not in politics, they have an interest in social change. Now, that includes conservative students. I mean, I've had some, you know, pretty conservative students in my classes, but that just adds to the class argument, the class discussion. If we were all liberals and leftists and socialists and radicals and progressives, it might become simply a, you know, nodding of the head kind of course. But when you get conservatives in the class, as long as they understand, you know, the rules of the game of you know, acting like a decent fellow student, it usually goes great. I mean, I've even had, you know, this organization Turning Points, underwritten by...
Yes, this is the Trump supporters indoctrination thing.
Yeah, it didn't start. I mean, actually,
that's what they are.
It's amazing you say that because it's underwritten by the Koch brothers. Ugh. And I can tell you that when Trump became the candidate, I thought Turning Point might actually become Never Trump.
Wow.
But they didn't.
Oh, no. They embrace him full on.
Right. Yeah. So as a consequence now, and I've had a couple of those students in my classes. And actually, in one sense, I get along quite well with them because they really think they're specialists on the Constitution. So it really provides for some very good banter in the classroom. Now, I mean, you know, I go in with the idea that democracy, in one sense, speaks for itself. You're either in favor of it or you want to set limits to it. And I obviously don't want to set limits to it. And it's up to the students if they want to come out as people and want to set limits to it.
Yeah. So, well, I'm hoping that you have some really intense and substantive dialogue in the classroom. I don't know how bright
people
are.
Well, I can put it this way. This is going to sound very Pollyanna-ish, for, you know, somebody late in the 60s. But here's what I say. People say to me, how long are you going to keep teaching? I'll be 70 this October.
Wow.
And they say, how long are you going to keep teaching? And I said, well, I don't know what I'd do if I wasn't teaching. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to spend my whole day writing. I like writing, but I don't want to spend the whole day doing it.
Right.
But the other thing is that even now, and I know this is going to sound very sort of cutesy, but I still have things to learn from students because we're so different in age that they keep me informed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I don't know a lot about what goes on in popular culture, but I end up knowing it because of them.
Right.
And they get sometimes they get a kick out of my look of ignorance when they mention something. So it's just plain fun. I've always told students for the 40 plus years of my teaching, starting when I was 27, I said to them that your job is to entertain me. And I don't mean as in make jokes and make me laugh.
Right.
That's good. But the idea is, as long as you entertain me, I'm going to feel really good about this class, and you'll do all the better as a consequence. So,
cool.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were listening before you came on, but I did a little bit of a rant, explained the controversy over at the New York Times, dealing with the headline and how that they had this fawning headline that they seemed to succumb to pressure to change, and even the new one was not very good. But taking it a step further, and how Maggie Haberman, there was a long Twitter thread, I found it, it's from last night, where she was so outraged that Congressman Joaquin Castro would put out a list of the 44 San Antonio citizens who have contributed the max amount allowed by federal law to Donald Trump. It's a matter of public record. I don't understand what the problem is and why somebody who's a venerable reporter from the New York Times would be calling him out in public for doing this, giving fodder to the right wingers who are saying that Castro doxed all these people. No, doxing is when you give out their home address and phone number. Telling their name, something that's widely available at the Federal Elections Commission's website.
Yeah, right.
It's public record.
That's amazing. Maggie Haberman did that? That's amazing.
Yep.
I mean, you know, the New York Times is a constant surprise to me these many weeks. As you know, I think I mentioned it. I was out of the country for 3 weeks.
Yes.
We were over in England. And it was a real pleasure to read that I could hold the newspaper, The Guardian, in my hands and read the commentary in there. Because, you know, the New York Times, you know, it's basically a capitally establishment newspaper with a liberal bent. But you and I both know that liberal bent, number one, their treatment of Bernie Sanders is just
horrible. It's everywhere. It's just awful. Everywhere in the corporate media today, the treatment of Bernie Sanders is not only horrible, it's really reprehensible. It is so wrong. And it's the media in the worst light doing what they're not supposed to be doing, which is taking sides. If they're journalists, they're supposed to be objective, or at least play one on television, you know, pretend to be objective. That's what they're supposed to do. I don't think all journalists are apolitical, but they're supposed to keep their own feelings out of the reporting. And that's not what happens anymore.
Yeah, I mean, part of that course I was just telling you about, Historical Perspectives in American Democracy, the students have to read the New York Times every day.
Good.
They have to get the online.
Uh-huh.
And for the first time this past year and now facing the new semester in a few weeks, it occurs to me that I really should make it a point of getting the students to look for the ways in which certain candidates are being treated, not simply by any one journalist or even on the editorial page alone, but the way in which the articles are written and the headings are given. So, for example, I mean, you and I just saw it the other day, that headline in the New York Times, Trump, what is it? Trump comes out against racism or something like that?
Here, I'll read you the exact, I know I had it right here. The headline read, the original headline was, Trump urges unity versus racism. Excuse me? Really? So that's what got Joan Walsh to tweet out that she canceled her New York Times subscription. So then they changed it for the second edition. Assailing hate, but not guns. Really? Do you think Trump assailed hate again?
That's incredible.
Hold on. Here's what he said. This is Donald Trump, you know, doing his shout over the whir of the helicopter arms. Here's what he said.
The blade. Yeah.
I am concerned about the rise of any group of hate. I don't like it. Any group of hate.
Really?
I am, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's any other kind of supremacy, whether it's Antifa.
Wait, hold on. Any other kind of supremacy, white supremacy, or any other kind of supremacy, because he can't give. Right. He can't make himself call out white supremacy as the evil that it is, and then, or any other kind of supremacy. And then the next group he comes up with, the only other one he can pull out is Antifa.
Yeah.
Which stands for anti-fascism. That's what Antifa is, and they're far, I mean, look, they're not even close to what they're fighting against. But, and then, wait, it gets
but
better.
You know, wait, wait, let me know, they're good people on both sides.
Of course. Well, that's kind of what he's saying here, and he continues. Yes. Wait.
Whether it's any group of hate, I am very concerned about it, and I'll do something about it.
Sure you will. I'll do something about it. Okay, there is a question here. Hold on.
No, I don't think my rhetoric has at all. I think my rhetoric is a very, it brings people together.
His rhetoric brings people together.
Yeah, I actually responded to that in a tweet. I said, yeah, it brings us all together against Donald Trump.
But
we shouldn't rely just on how much we despise Trump. We got to create some new solidarities.
Yes, I agree. So you had messaged me after the debates, and you're like, you think we can talk next week? And you know, Harvey J.K., you always have an open door here. Anytime there's something you want to talk about, all you have to do is say, let's do it, and we do it. So what is the burning thing on your mind these days?
Well,
what's
at that? Okay, so first on the debates, and then I want to talk to you about that Cory Booker thing that I sent to you as well.
Okay.
I slept through the debates because I was in England. I would have had to be up, you know, so I slept through. So, but then when I woke up and everybody else was going to sleep, I noticed that the sense was that Elizabeth Warren was the champion of the evening. And I figured, okay,
good. Well, the first night, I actually thought both Bernie and Elizabeth Warren had a great night.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's where I'm going. Because remember, all I knew was what people were saying on Twitter or in quotes, the media.
Well, the media, they reluctantly admitted that Elizabeth Warren had a good night, but boy, they couldn't bring themselves to say that Bernie killed it, because he did, right?
Okay, so then I did start picking up the fact that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren really were like a tag team match against the centrists, you know, the moderates, the conservatives.
The conservadems, yes. Right.
Yeah. And then I sent some notes to people hit back here in the States. The one I sent to you was, I want to come on.
Right.
but I sent to some journalists and others. And what I was getting back was from journalists about their own, you know, their own media, you might say, is why is it that we can't seem to say that Bernie had the best night?
It's incredible.
Which is what you basically felt.
And I don't know what kind of if you had access to CNN or MSNBC over there, but the commentary on both those channels, because I flipped back and forth before I turned it off in disgust, was just so dismissive of Bernie Sanders. And building up of the conservadems, according to many of them on MSNBC, John Delaney, Michael Bennett, Steve Bullock, these are the people who did the best. I'm like, they're what?
Yeah.
Who?
You know what? I was up. So, okay. When it was, let's see, 11 or midnight in the United States, I guess it was about 6 a.m.
Right. Yeah. You're 5 hours ahead over there.
Early.
Right.
And I plugged in and I did hear some of that commentary, which is, I was kind of floored because I was reading, you know, I was reading one place where it was that Warren had the great night. And then it turns out there was a tag team. And then I'm hearing this commentary. So I've come back and I've given up. CNN, MSNBC is,
jump,
you know,
the shark.
It's just out of my, and I really did appreciate that that tweet you sent out about the Mimi Rocha remark.
Do you believe that?
Which I saw over in England. I just couldn't believe that. No, in fact, the ironic thing was, it was just about 48 hours before that she followed me on Twitter. So I was all, right, which I thought was hilarious.
Uh-huh.
So I figured I better follow back and after what I've seen and see what else she's going to say about the guys I like or the women I like. Man, it was just awful. But the thing that was on my mind today, because I was thinking that you and I, for the first time ever, were probably going into a conversation with no agenda, apparently,
right,
mostly to catch up.
Right.
But I saw this tweet this morning from Kyle Griffin.
Yes.
And he was quoting
Cory
Booker.
And Kyle Griffin works at MSNBC. I believe he's a producer on The Last Word.
Right, right. Yep. His tweets are better than MSNBC.
Yes, very much so. Yep.
And he said, in quote, White supremacy has always been a problem in our American story, Cory Booker says. Further quote, we need to be more honest about not just who we are, but who we have been. And I thought, fair enough. But it's the same old, it's that same old stuff, which basically we all have come to know is that, yes, we have this tragic and terrible history of slavery and racism. And let's not forget, in all of these discussions, we've seen now the attack on just about every single community in the United States from the far right, murderous attacks, a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Mexican Americans down in El Paso, African Americans in South Carolina. I mean, we can, if this doesn't present a pattern that we can recognize, what else can we say, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing is, as much as we take note, and as much as we do our damnedest to recognize the burden of exploitation and oppression, et cetera, that we carry, I think I want to make another argument. I want to make a case, which I've been making on your show for all these years, I guess, is that what we need to do is we need to remember that for 200 and more years, we have had struggle after struggle, basically to confront the exploitation and the oppression and the murderousness that we've witnessed. And the fact is we have, in fact, made things far better than they have ever been. And if anything, our failing now is not that we don't realize the story of America's oppressive past, but rather that we don't make enough of the struggles and the heroes that basically can give us examples and lessons and inspiration and encouragement to take on the fight, not just to lament, but to make things different, you know? And this is the thing. I really do think that we've got to overcome not simply the shame, but we also have to overcome the sense of guilt, not by necessarily, you know, ignoring it, but by literally changing history, not of the past, but the changing of the history that we ourselves are living. I mean, I can't say that enough.
Well, I mean, look, there are those of us who believe that we're doing the work to change history every day. Obviously, history does change every day. I hate to say it. Donald Trump changed history more than anyone I can think of in our recent history. I think you have to go back to, I hate to say it, and I hate to draw the parallel, but it is there, to Adolf Hitler. Hitler is the last one who did something like this. I have a dear friend who's visiting me from California this week. She's actually leaving tonight. I need to drive her to the airport after the show. And she's apolitical. We worked in music radio together. She now teaches second grade, never turns on the television, knows that Trump is an idiot, but tries not to deal with it. And, you know, the conversations we've been having are pretty intense because she sees all the, you know, the results of what he's doing, but doesn't know the specifics. And as I've been explaining to her over the last couple of days about the things that he's been doing, she's obviously history is changing. We need to change it in a bigger way to get rid of this hatred, this bigotry, this racism that so many of us, look, I had Tim Wise on the show yesterday, and he's just brilliant on the subject of racism. You know, I feel really stupid now because I really thought after the election of Barack Obama that we had sort of jumped over a hurdle, that we cleared a new hurdle, that we were on the road to being better. Little did I realize that the hate and the racism and the bigotry was festering until Donald Trump came along and gave these people permission to bring it out in the open. And now we're seeing how much ugliness there really is in this country, how much abject racism, bigotry, hatred for fellow human beings. It's so disheartening, and it's, I think, why so many people are suffering from severe depression right now.
Okay, but here's the thing. This I speak in terms as a historian and a sociologist, and I'm not going to say that it was not there in the past. In fact, I think it was always there in the past. The question is the degree to which other solidarities existed that overrode it. Huh. So, for example, when one of every three American workers was in a labor union, and increasingly labor unions were being integrated in the 1970s, the fact is that those solidarities helped transcend those hatreds. So like back in the 1930s when the CIO was organized and you had And basically they were organizing, you know, workers in steel and rubber work and all the industries that brought in Southern workers, white and black. And these folks didn't get along, and whites came, brought their racisms to bear. But when they worked together, they found they had another struggle that they could participate in. And generally speaking, there was serious advancement in terms of race, even though we know the ugliness that transpires in American history. But now for 45 years, they've destroyed labor unions. Hell, they've destroyed, their corporate interests have destroyed all of our solidarities. And as a consequence, you get a guy like Trump, and the Republican Party generally is able to cultivate those hatreds and bring them forth, because there are no transcendent solidarities. And we really do need to develop those solidarities in order to contain and perhaps ultimately wipe out these kinds of feelings and attitudes and relationships and structures.
Okay.
So that's the key. Now, and I'll give you an example of, so I was really impressed. You know, I was trying to catch up these last few days listening to YouTube and things like that. Yeah. Sarah Nelson, who's the head of the flight attendants union, she gave a speech, which I only just came across. It was a few weeks ago, but I came across both in writing on the Jacobin website and also on YouTube.
Right.
And she gave a speech at a Chicago meeting, the Chicago DSA or something like that. And it was a speech in which she really does take hold of American history and includes not only American experience, but European experience as well, and talks about the struggles that have gone into the making of solidarities, which have been under siege these 40 years. And I want to urge all of your listeners, all of our friends, to go onto YouTube and just type in Sarah Nelson, Chicago DSA, and to watch and listen to this young woman's address to that convention. It was really powerful, very moving. I really can imagine there's a possibility she can rise in the AFL-CIO, maybe even become president of the AFL-CIO in a couple of years. So the possibilities are there, but not simply to dwell on the tragedy, but also to remember the struggles that have, in many cases, succeeded in making the United States more like the America that's in sort of expressed in the promise of the Declaration, even then it was never realized. That's the key thing to
right,
me.
Right, right. No, I hear you. I hear you. There's so much, again, going on that we need to reconcile. Everything's different. I'm sorry. This just crossed my Twitter stream, and I'm, you know, one of the things I was talking to my friend Terry, who's visiting, we talked about the tone from this president and how he says things no president in the world, certainly in the United States, has ever said. So he just tweeted, I guess from Air Force One, tweeted, just left Dayton, Ohio, where I met with the victims and families, law enforcement, medical staff, and first responders. It was a warm and wonderful visit, tremendous enthusiasm, and even love. Then I saw failed presidential candidate, 0%, Sherrod Brown.
Oh, my God.
Sherrod Brown never ran for president. He decided against running for president. This guy is such a piece of shit.
Absolutely.
He lies with impunity.
Absolutely.
It just, it's infuriating. And I don't understand when I said to my friend that his approval rating among Republicans is in the 90s, her jaw dropped. She couldn't believe it. And I said, now a lot of Republicans have left the party, but still the fact that those remaining, he has a 90%+ approval rating. It's just unbelievable. And then he continues, Sherrod Brown and Mayor Wiley totally misrepresenting what took place inside the hospital. Their news conference after I left for El Paso was a fraud. It bore no resemblance to what took place. I mean, he's got such an ego that he has to tweet about this shit now?
Well, okay. So that's incredible. That's exactly what
I
expected. In fact, I think it was Sherrod Brown. Earlier, I read something where he said he was explaining why he was going to go to Dayton, since it's his state. He was going to go to Dayton to encounter or meet Trump. And he said, you know, he was going to encourage him to say certain kinds of things. And I tweeted back and I said, you can waste your time any way you want. Keep in mind that I would have voted for you. I would vote for you, but I can tell you that you are definitely wasting your time. Yep. Please put it to better use. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, that's like the likes of Jake Tapper. I don't know if you remember, I got in a fight with him on Twitter about a year ago when he actually made the remark on Twitter that he, or actually on the air, he said that he believes deep down Trump loves America.
Oh, God.
I thought, what the fuck?
Oh, God. Well, and his questions during the debate were reprehensible. It was, and I thought, I complained and bitched and moaned about NBC's debate. CNN made NBC look like the gold standard, look like the League of Women Voters, who really needs to come back and take over these presidential debates again, because this commercial run by the networks, turning it into a game show, reality show, is bullshit. It cheapens the presidency, as if, you know, Trump hasn't completely put it into the dollar bin.
It really ought to be the case. The major networks, or at the least PBS, should take on the debates.
Well, or the League of Women Voters should take it
back. Well, it should be actually run by the League of Women. Yeah. Sorry, indeed, the League of Women Voters should be running these things.
Yeah.
In fact, by the way, the other thing I picked up pretty quickly was that CNN was even worse when I woke
horrible.
Up. Was even worse than MSNBC.
Embarrassingly bad.
I even wondered to myself, well, gee, maybe all the Democrats should have the debate on Fox. At least they'll know what to expect, and we can get angry on the right away.
Right, exactly. So, Harvey J.K., we've got a few minutes left. Now, I do know that you have a new book coming out. In fact, you're releasing it right around my birthday. So that was very kind of you to
Right, and to I do want that. Everyone to know that you are properly acknowledged in there as one of the people who enabled me to develop the arguments in the book.
Wow. So tell us about it. This is
a collection of speeches, basically, and essays of the last several years. So it's sort of it begins very deeply inside of the Obama years. And now it's going to seem a little strange, but I remember my constant need to criticize and take on the Obama administration and the Democrats. I mean, let's face it. We're in the circumstances we're in because the Democrats failed to be Democrats for decades.
That needs a ding, because you're so spot on. Absolutely. And I get yelled at by, you know, Democrats. Why do you criticize Obama so much? Because he was a shitty president. Right. He could have done so much. And anyway, go ahead. Continue.
Well,
sorry.
Well, from Carter to Clinton to Obama, you might say. I don't hold back at all.
Uh-huh.
But it's also the case that I then also wrap the book in this argument about the imperative. And this is, again, I sound like I'm a broken record, but I am a broken record and I don't mind it. The fact is that we really do need to take hold of our history. We need to remind, look, Americans, when crises occurred in the past, like the revolution itself, the Civil War, the 1930s Depression, World War II, Americans somehow found it in themselves, for all of our sins and all of the tragic elements in our story, we found it in ourselves to transcend the crisis, not simply by coming together, but by actually making America radical for a while. Actually making America radical. So the argument in this book is to remind Americans, first of all, of the radical tradition that we carry with us, even if we can't speak openly of it to all, you know, because we just don't have the words.
Right.
We also have to remind ourselves of those crises and how we ourselves transcended those crises by making America radical again. The book is titled Take Hold of Our History, Make America Radical Again. But I also want to remind people, if they feel angry, if they feel like things are shit, it's because of all of those struggles of the past embedded in them. So it's like a deep cultural memory that this is not the way it's supposed to be.
No.
And the trick is to remember that we carry the American promise and it's up to us. And we can lament the situation all we want, but we really do need to create new solidarities and revive the solidarities of the past. My own feeling is that we need to revive the labor movement because it is the most powerful and dynamic force in the possibility of changing America.
Without a doubt. And it was really responsible for the rise of the middle class. And the United States back in, you know, what, the 50s, 60s, had the best, most burgeoning middle class possible.
That's right.
It's because of unions. And we've
absolutely
fucked them over. So the book will be published when?
I hope we can talk more about those kinds of things.
Most definitely. And I will have read the book by then. Again, the publication date is?
Well, it's going to be October 25th.
Okay.
It's not even on the websites yet.
No.
But I tweeted today the cover that's come out. So
awesome.
I'm very excited. I think it's one of the most beautiful covers I've ever had for a book.
Great. Can't wait. Harvey J.K. Find him on Twitter at Harvey J.K. And of course, we'll speak to him before the book comes out. But certainly when it's out, we'll have
a party. I love you, Nicole. I'll talk to you soon.
Love you, too. Thank you so much, Harvey.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Tomorrow's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. In the meantime, keep the faith, baby. See you tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.